Welcome to Keeping Up With Data. Keeping Up With Data is the podcast that keeps data enthusiasts up to speed with what is happening in the data world. We bring in the leading minds from the data industry to talk all things career, news, embarrassing stories, failures, and successes.
Welcome to Keeping Up With Data. I'm Emily.
I'm Charlotte.
And today we've got an amazing guest, Sandy. Sandy, I'm going to let you introduce yourself, but just briefly, we're obviously going to be covering topics that are relatively sensitive, obviously data being a big part of this, but equally mental health, well-being, suicide. There's a lot of those topics that aren't like great or nice for people to hear. So just be aware, and I'll hand it over to you.
Sure. So thanks so much for having me. Hi, everyone. My name is Sanderson, but Sandy's a little bit easy to say. And so I'm a researcher at the Black Dog Institute. We're affiliated with University of New South Wales. And my area of research is seeing how do we really meet people where they are when they're distressed? Mm-hmm. And what that translates to in practice is using scalable digital interventions to identify and reach people who are thinking of ending their lives or at a really dark point in where they're at.
That is like awesome. So I suppose to expand on that, like how did your career go from studying and all the way into that? And that obviously is a very big passion of yours because I can hear it in your voice.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you don't mind me sharing a little bit of my story, is that my life has sort of been this, I've been locked into a battle with mental health and with suicidality my entire life. So what do I mean by that? So when I was born, a couple months after I was born, my father experienced extremely severe panic attacks. So he was an executive at a very large company, and it's the kind of panic attacks that makes you stay home for the next 3 months. It's a kind of panic attack that sends you to the ER. And because at the time, this was many, many years ago, and it was in Indonesia, they didn't really understand what was going on. Our understanding of psychiatry, even back then, especially back then, wasn't great. And so they thought that it was my fault as a newborn baby, that there was some sort of spiritual disconnect between me and my father. And so my family actually symbolically gave me away for a period of time to actually just separate that bond between me and my father because of the anxiety that he had. And so that was only chapter one of it. And unfortunately, in my own life, because of a lot of things that happened, I was diagnosed with major depressive disorder. There was one period of time a couple of years ago where it actually got so dark that I walked around during the day thinking about how I would end my life, actually later that evening.
Wow.
I was thinking about what I would do, where I would do it, and so on and so forth. And what actually stopped me, that I can genuinely say saved my life, and I wouldn't be here if that didn't happen, is someone actually came over and gave me a hug. Somebody came over and gave me a hug, and they could clearly tell something was a little bit off. And so they gave me a hug and they reassured me. So I think since then, it's really been my life's mission. Can I give that to other people? Because the research shows us that actually a lot of people who are thinking of ending their lives, a lot of them don't want to die. In fact, they're looking for any reason to keep on living, to continue on. And sometimes that's why a tap on the shoulder, a text message, or even an internet pop-up could be that reason for someone to continue on. That's where I decided to continue doing my doctorate in psychology. I did something slightly different back then, but I was always thinking, how do I go into applied mental health, applied suicide prevention? And then right after, really, really fortunate, I was able to land a job at the Black Dog Institute. And that's where I started getting involved in digital interventions and AI. And it's all about how do we reach the most amount of people in the most relevant and personal way. In my case, a lot of the research I do uses advertising algorithms to just sort of find people who might be searching up suicide-related keywords, send a message and go, hey, are you all right? Is there anything that we can do?
Wow, that is like a huge start. And also, thank you for being so vulnerable because that's a hard thing to sort of acknowledge, but it sounds like you've kind of gone through a very good healing process, and it's always a work in progress, I think, that kind of stuff, because I've also been affected by a lot of that kind of anxiety, depression, people in my life as well that are still dealing with that to this day. And I think it's just important to acknowledge it and like be aware. So thank you for acknowledging it. I'm sure Charlotte, you've also experienced that with people in your life. And
yeah, and it's I think we even spoke about before we started, kind of like the still stigma of talking about mental health. And I think that vulnerability and being open just gives a massive sort of message back out. And one of the main things I think we even spoke about was being open and talking about it. You've mentioned a hug, those sort of things that we can quite easily do that we maybe don't think about have so much more of an impact. So yeah, really interesting to share.
Yeah, it's interesting you say hug as well, because obviously like COVID is a big piece of the puzzle here for you and your role at Black Dog, I imagine, because you've kind of been through that, you've, what, 4 or 5 years at Black Dog now? And I feel, I might be wrong, but I feel like so many people are so apprehensive about touch now, massively, even still today, like kind of a bit, almost like taboo. I don't know, it's maybe the wrong word, but in some senses. So maybe tell us how you got through COVID from, maybe you could do personal, but also from the Black Dog Institute side and your day-to-day work.
Oh, absolutely. I'll be the first to admit that the first half year of COVID was really hard on me. I mean, for me, one of the things that helps me decompress, especially working in this field, is going to my friend's house and barbecuing each weekend. And he's an exec in the airline industry. And all we would do is we would barbecue skewers and we would just talk about our work and talk about our day. And not having that was really, really tough for me. So on a personal level, it was genuinely, it took a lot of adaptation. And there wasn't really a point where I would say, oh, I just switched around and suddenly felt great. It took a while to really adapt and to get used to what people call the new normal. But one of the things that's quite interesting is that Black Dog actually had a push against the term social distancing, because we don't want to be socially distant. We want to be physically distant. We don't really want to touch, but we still want to be connected. And I think that not having that physical contact isn't great, especially for me because I'm a hugger. But we still need to be socially connected. That's why one of the things that I would do with my friends is they would have me on an iPad and sitting on the couch. They just put me next to them as they would watch something and we just continue chatting.
That's so good.
But in terms of work, so the COVID pandemic hit really badly in Australia only a couple of months after I started my role. And this is the challenging thing, because we were working with large amounts of extremely sensitive data. So we would have to bring in about 20 terabytes every week.
Wow.
And the only way to do that is to go to a physical location, leave the hard drives, and actually have it downloaded and come back the next week to pick it up at a very specific time.
Old school.
Yeah, absolutely. Because that was the only way to get it across in time for the analysis. But we adapted. We managed to get permissions and we, of course, did the safety protocols. But that was genuinely quite challenging because we were working on a project with lots and lots of data at that time.
Oh my gosh, that would have been so strange and surreal. I feel like the barbecues and everything like that is just like, even in when we did social distancing, but more like a lockdown in Sydney, where you could do like picnics and all that stuff. I actually really miss that. Do you? Yeah. I feel like it was quite wholesome and like that. Obviously, that's more of the positive side of COVID. Like you kind of brought together with like more basic living and, I don't know, appreciating the simple things, you know?
Oh, it absolutely is. And I don't go on walks. I don't go on runs. But that forced me to go out with somebody in a close suburb, a friend, and we would take walks together.
Yeah.
And I kind of, you're right, I do kind of miss that. It was nice walking in the park and things like that.
Yeah, now you're just like back to the hustle and bustle to a degree. You got to keep yourself grounded a little bit. But anyways, what about on the work side, obviously with drawing on what you've said about Black Dog and obviously being 2 months after COVID hit, you started Black Dog. Obviously you've been there 4 years, you've probably achieved a lot. Like tell us maybe what Black Dog has been working on and you've been working on that would be really good to highlight to people that in turn will kind of, I suppose, help the rest of us sort of talk about this kind of stuff as well.
Yeah, absolutely. If I could talk about the amazing things that my mentors and colleagues do at Black Dog, I could go far beyond the length of this podcast. For example, when I was coming in, Black Dog was running the world's first national implementation of suicide prevention strategies in local communities. They called that the lifespan trials. Black Dog was running the world's largest suicide and mental health prevention trial in eighth graders, the trial that they call future proofing. And so I came into Black Dog thinking and with the understanding that changing the world is a norm. doing things that no one has ever done before is our norm. It's our day to day. And so one of the projects that I currently lead now is, it's got several different names, but more commonly known as the Hope Exchange. And the thought is this: unfortunately, even today, 50 to 60% of people won't seek professional help prior to a suicide. Even with our different hotlines, even with our different services, that's a major gap. But one of the things that we know is that people will search for things in the privacy of their browsers, in the privacy of their search engines. And so it kind of makes sense that if they're searching up suicide-related keywords and we're able to respond to that, in the simple form of an ad, we might be able to help someone. We touched on this a couple of minutes ago. But what's incredible about it is that, number one, there's so much tailoring and targeting. So, for example, if I was talking to my wife, talking to her and she was going through a tough day, and then my brother, who I also live with, came in the room and he's having a tough day, I would speak to them differently because they're different people. We all are different people. We respond to different messages. We have different challenges. And so what the tailoring and targeting does, it allows us to break down by language, by geography, by age, and by all these different parameters, with the end goal that each person is likely to receive a message that's most relevant to them in that really dark period of time. Because we don't know if they're searching for suicide-related keywords, especially surrounding methods, we may have minutes. That's why it's really important for us to be able to grab their attention as fast as we can. So we've actually trialed this on Google Ads. We've done big ads, and recently we've done Reddit as well. We've done this in Australia, Indonesia, and the US, with collaboration starting up in India and Germany and several different countries as well. And one of the things that we found is that, obviously, when they get to the page, we don't want them to just look at it and go, okay, it's time. We want them to engage in a meaningful way, because these are evidence-based modules and videos and messages designed to de-escalate their suicidal crisis. And then so we look at the conversion or engagement rate, how they're engaging with that. So we found an engagement rate that's approximately 4 times the industry standard.
Wow.
In Australia and in the US. We trialed this in Indonesia, where mental health resources are sparse and stigma is very high, and it performed 20 times better than it did in Australia.
Oh my
God. The engagement rate was 20 times better, suggesting a real unmet need in Indonesia and similarly a lot of low to middle income countries. We ran this on Reddit as well. We worked together with our wonderful partners from Group M and Wavemaker. And the tricky thing about Reddit and Meta is that they don't use keywords, right? It's not a search engine, but they use interest and subreddits and communities. So personally, I was skeptical we would actually reach people who are in suicidal crisis. In 14 days, in just 14 days, where we placed the ad specifically for people who are thinking of ending their lives, we had over 49,000 clicks on that ad to a site for people looking for help.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
And so the demand is there. The people, we know where they are. This is where they are. And this is where we come in, and we use the knowledge that we have of data analytics, of the industry and of tailoring, to increase the engagement. Because if I'm selling, say, chicken, engagement means more chicken sold. Here, an engagement is potentially life-saving. Here, somebody engaging with it potentially means a family is spared a suicide of a family member. And so that's why it's so important that we continue optimizing in the best ways that we know how.
Gosh, that's incredible. Like, the impact that you can make just off the back of even what you've just said there, the one Reddit example, like, that's mental. No pun intended.
I think that's really interesting. What you said at the start, though, is what people struggle with is that initial reaching out for help, and actually just something as simple as being on your laptop and then having it targeted. It's more of like a proactive approach, I guess, rather than in some ways waiting for them to come to you. It's kind of going there first. So it sounds really, massive impact there.
But that's really good, because that's what we're trying to do. One of the things that I mentioned, and is really the core philosophy of my work, is to just really meet them where they are. To speak in a language that resonates with them. And so the data shows that as of 2019, there are 1 billion health-related searches on Google every day.
Wow.
That's not including people using social media search engines, because we know that a lot of people will find doctors' treatments on different social media sites. So if we as a public health sector aren't using data analytics and what we know to actually be where they are, then what are we really doing? That's what it means to meet them where they are and communicate with them in a way that we understand, to be proactive, not forceful, not coercing anything at all, but just being really present to where the people are.
This might be a question you can't answer, so tell me if you can't, but with the targeted approach to those types of audiences, like, is it that you share videos? Is it that you, like, what kind of content, what does it look like effectively, if you can answer that?
Oh, of course. Okay. So one of the most important things I'd like to highlight is that the development of these pages, they're co-designed, meaning that we work together with people who lived and living experience of suicide and mental health distress, and we're facilitating them. We ask them, what do you think would help people? And it's our jobs to be able to create that and put it on the page. And so, for example, when we first designed this, I thought that, all right, we need hotlines. And then we had these sessions with them, these really rich discussions and these focus groups. And one of the things that really stood out to me is when a lived experience advisor said to me, Sandy, we're not seeking help, not because there's nothing out there, but because so far what we've seen is out there isn't necessarily helpful. And that really, really opened my eyes. Another person said, Sandy, it's not necessarily about the lack of choice, but sometimes it's too much choice. Because when a person's in distress, there's something called cognitive narrowing, where there's not as much capacity. A person, one of them put it akin to getting off a long haul flight. Sometimes you need the signs just a little bit bigger. You need the roads to be a little bit clearer. And so we asked them, what do you need? And so we had people sharing their stories on the site. We had relaxation, we had distracting exercises, we had many, many different things, but we entrusted them with it. So that's what we have available on these sites. Now, when it comes to the tailoring, it can be very minor things. So one of my favorite things is we did this targeting exercise in Indonesia. And there's a place in Indonesia called Central Java. In Central Java, they speak the national language, which is Indonesian, but they also speak a dialect called Javanese. Now, everybody speaks Indonesian, and of course, in government and informal events, they use it as well. But Javanese is a language you'd use to speak to your mother. Javanese is a language you'd use to order something off some food off the street. Javanese is a language you'd use to curse at somebody who cut you off on the road. So that's the language that resonates with their heart.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, they understand Indonesian, but what if we used a language that's close to their hearts, especially for times of distress? Here's where it got a little bit tricky. Google as doesn't accept Javanese.
Oh, no.
So what I had to do is I had to finesse this. And I'm sure this won't get me into any trouble. But what I did is I slowly added more and more and more Javanese onto the page in the ad until it wouldn't let me. So, like, how much can I get away with? Oh, so adding Javanese on the page. So we had the full Indonesian page. And we had as much Javanese as Google Ads would allow. And so we did A-B testing. We ran it in that area where we knew that's how they spoke the language. We almost tripled the rate of professional help seeking that trial. People calling a helpline, people looking for a psychologist. Why? Because when we talk to them, we're not only talking to their minds, but we're really talking to their hearts. And so that's one of the examples of the tailoring that we had.
Yeah. Wow. I feel like, everyone would feel so seen, because it does feel quite like you said, you're not just like looking at something on a screen that's just like means nothing. It means something, because you've done so much work to get to that point and analyze the people and take into the account, not just the numbers, but like qualitative side. Yeah. Where you've done the focus groups and everything like that. So that's amazing.
Thank you.
How do you feel making such an impact in your job like that?
That's a good question. I've never really considered that I make an impact.
What?
Because I honestly grew in my career surrounded by so many incredible people.
Yeah. Mm.
But honestly, bringing back, it's all very personal to me. I'm here today because somebody helped me. And if I'm able to help somebody in the same way, it's just as rewarding to me.
Yeah.
So I'm really glad that I get to do it. And this is where I love data analytics. I'm actually a real introvert. I like working with mathematical models and things like that, rather than having to engage with people.
Like this podcast.
I'm still very nervous, in case you can't tell.
No, you can't
tell at all.
But what I absolutely, and if you don't mind me sharing something perhaps slightly heavy here, One of the things that this job has taught me is that there are people behind the numbers. One of the questions someone asked me is like, why do we need data? And the simple answer I always give is because if I want to help someone, I need to know their story. And what is data but a collection of these stories in a way that we can easily process, mm-hmm. in a way that's beneficial to what we're trying to do at the moment. So for example, one of the big moves in suicide prevention now is understanding it's not just about medicine, it's not just about psychiatry, it's about social determinants, it's about family, community, having a roof over your head, having employment, having that self-esteem. Mm-hmm. And that could just be a figure. It could say that, okay, so-and-so percentage, there's an odds ratio of sort of finance or unemployment linking with suicidality. That means something different to me when now I've had a, because I've had a friend and unfortunately the person was unemployed. And it means something different to me when that one night I had to hold the person from actually ending his own life for a solid hour he was frustrated about not having employment, of seeing his life go in a direction he didn't really want. And so what I love about this job, it's definitely not easy, but what I love about this job, it teaches me that these analyses, these numbers, these mathematical models, they mean something. They actually have people behind them. They have phenomena behind them. They have context and setting and stories behind them. And that's one of the reasons I love doing what I do.
I mean, powerful. And I'm sorry to hear that you had to go through that as well. And your friend. I was going to ask, but more like a lot of executives and businesses don't understand that correlation between the data and the meaning. And I feel like you've just summed it up really well there. And obviously you work for a great company that has that kind of, I suppose, leg up a little bit, because that's their focus, is to look after people and prevent that kind of thing happening. I wonder, you might not be able to answer this either, I'm just throwing you on the spot here, but if you're talking to an executive in a company that isn't mental health, suicide prevention research, that kind of focus, more from a traditional sense, maybe it's banking or retail or something, how would you make the impact you just did on me by describing how much of like data and meaning come together and how you formulate a story?
Yeah.
But not on the, this is really waffly, but basically not on the mental health and well-being side. Like, how do you get the buy-in, I suppose, is what I'm asking.
Absolutely. So I think it would be unfair to expect every executive to care about the same things that we do. Mm. It's definitely not about morality. It's definitely not about that at all. But it's about understanding what's important to them. Because if I'm able to communicate to a banker, understanding the context of the people who walk through your doors, understanding their lives, you're able to increase your bottom line, then that's something that I think they'll understand.
Yeah, interesting. That's a good way to put it. I think a lot of people go into like heavy solution mode, don't they? Like immediately, instead of actually qualifying, like you've just said there, qualifying what they need, what's important to them, and then going into solution mode. It's always a classic that comes up with our interview processes with people in general as well. Like, they're like, oh, tell me what you did here. And they're like, well, I built this really cool model or whatever. But they don't articulate how to frame up a problem, understand all the nuances, go and ask the right questions and stuff. So awesome. What about this question? So like if you're talking to a five-year-old and they're like, what do you do? Like, hello. What would you say to them to describe it?
That's a really great, I feel the questions are progressively getting tougher as we go along, justifiably so. I don't know. I don't think I would be able to introduce the concept of suicide without their parents' consent.
Oh my God, yeah.
So the simplest way, if I had a niece or a nephew that was 5 years old and I said, oh, Sandy, what do you do? And I was like, oh, you know what? I try to help people. I try to understand what they're going through. Meaning, in our sense, that means data analytics, quantitative, qualitative. Mm. And I try to find solutions that they'll accept and that will help them, meaning the implementation. That's the way I would try to describe it.
And I love hugs.
Yeah, and I love hugs, absolutely.
Did you ever find that person that gave you a hug or like?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah? It's a good friend of mine. And in fact, one of the things that kept me going, because unfortunately, when you have major depressive disorder, those episodes aren't one-off.
Yeah.
They come again and again. And it's a community of people who really cared for me and loved me. One of the people that I still do barbecues with. And I was actually best man at his wedding.
What?
So, lovely. And it's having that relationships around me that one of the things that keeps me sane. And another thing that's really helped me get to where I am today.
That is amazing. What about the topic of, this is also to do with, I suppose, the physical distancing versus the social distancing that you mentioned that kind of sparked something in me around the flexibility of being in office versus not. Like, where do you stand on that? Like, and everyone's kind of figuring out their new normal, right? And like, we were really remote, then still people are remote now, but other businesses have pushing you in to go mandated 2-3 days or maybe 1 day, that's the company one. Like, where do you sit in that realm?
That's a good question, and I have to preface, this is just my opinion.
Sorry.
this is just my opinion. So as much as I would like to be tucked away in the comfort of my own home and being able to have my own space, I do think, even to often my own protest, that coming into the office and meeting people is incredibly beneficial. There are some conversations that can only happen spontaneously. There are some ideas that can only come spontaneously. And I think that in conjunction with the rigor of data analysis, there's also the creativity behind it as well. And sometimes that only comes when we're in a space and something is bubbling up, and then we have these, and then we have these ideas. And so I think that what I would like is to just live on a farm somewhere in isolation and take care of like my little flowers and things like that. But I do know that meeting people, talking to them, spending time together is good for my mental health, is good for my creativity. And so I think that's where each company just needs to strike the balance between the two.
I feel like we've talked about this at work a lot, but like, to treat everyone the same, you have to treat everyone individually. And so like, balance for someone over here might be different for someone over here, and like what you said there is like, I suppose, exactly what I believe too, but it's really hard to figure out how to communicate that effectively, especially if you're in a big corporate, I suppose, with like one person has this rule, the other person has this rule. If you don't effectively all know that everyone has different rules, then it's chaos.
It really is. And you've hit the nail on the head there, because being able to understand each person and bring out the best with them, isn't that what great managers do?
Exactly.
Being able to understand, because for me, and this is, I'm just sharing my own stories here, that sometimes it's difficult for me to be productive when I'm in a room with other people. Even if the person's doing their own thing, there's something about having my own space, letting my thoughts go wild, sometimes having my own music playing that really gets me going. And so if I was forced, of course they don't do that, but if I was forced at some point by some company to come in and be full, I may not be as productive as I am now. And so I'm grateful that I have a great manager who understands that, is able to accommodate it, and knows how to bring out the best in me.
And then I guess you get the flip side of people who do their best work when they're surrounded by other people and other ideas. So it's like a combination of the two rather than a blanket. Rule. It's interesting.
Totally. Yeah. And also for skill sets in different like industries and stuff, I suppose it's very different. But yes, individual based is best. I see you've done some work with the WHO. Tell us more about what you've been doing with them.
Sure. So with the WHO, a lot of my focus is actually on national strategies. Like with any sort of good company, even down to a team, we need an action plan, right? We need to learn how to work together, how to collaborate, how to do something well. Countries and regions, they often have what we call like action plans or strategies, which means it's a collection of different intervention works and programs that are multi-stakeholder in order to achieve a certain goal. In this case, it's often preventing suicide. And that might mean working together with the healthcare system, with the hotlines, with education, with housing, for example, to be able to have one cohesive program, and working together also with the different registries and hospitals to actually have surveillance on what are the numbers doing? Are they going up? Are they going down? To have that in a single plan to be able to prevent suicide. And so with countries and regions, they develop these plans. And some of the work that I've done for the WHO is I review them. I check them, I go, okay, let's see if this is in line with the literature. Is there anything we need to add? So for example, just hypothetically, a country would go, oh, we want to do this, this, and this. And I'm like, oh, you're missing a specific part, which we know, having worked on the field, really benefits these efforts, which is working together with local stakeholders. And how do we factor that in on a regional level and on a country level as well? So yeah, that's some of the work that I've done with the WHO.
I feel like it kind of hits what you've just said earlier about the, like, it can't just be data, it has to be understanding the cultures and, like, the types of people and what the kind of intricacies are of that community and stuff like that to actually fully get an understanding, which is awesome. Charlotte, you have a really burning question.
Yeah, well, I must admit, I was stalking your LinkedIn a little bit earlier and saw a pretty impressive picture on there. So I've heard you've done a TED talk. Could you tell us a little bit more about that, Sandy?
Sure.
you're famous.
No, don't worry. So in 2022, I had the wonderful opportunity to do a talk for TEDx Sydney. It was amazing. When I linked up with them, there was this audition process, and I got through that, and they actually pair us up with someone to actually train us how to carry ourselves on stage. So I had the chance to talk about digital marketing and suicide prevention. What does big data mean for suicide prevention? It's one of the most terrifying things I've done in my life. So there I am in Sydney in town hall, basically. And what they do is you're standing stage left on the steps, and there's a hand on your shoulder. Your cue is literally two taps on your shoulder. Go up to the red X and talk. That's it. Oh my God. And on top of that,
terrifying.
On that day, the clicker wasn't working as well as I would like, which is unfortunately just one of the things that we can't foresee. But on one hand, so you're looking at two screens, right, in the audience. On one screen, you're seeing, oh, my slides are malfunctioning. On the other screen, you're seeing the countdown.
Panic.
But it was,
and there's someone going like this, wrap it up. No. Oh,
thankfully, no. But the TEDx Sydney team is one of the best teams I've ever worked with. Absolutely incredible. But I got a chance to talk about it and was really fortunate. And it speaks to sort of their curational abilities that it actually got picked up and featured on the TED website. Mm. And as a result of that, people contacted Black Dog and me from all across the world saying, wow, how do we do this?
Yeah.
We want to bring this to our country. Somebody contacted me from the United Arab Emirates. Somebody contacted me from India. Somebody contacted me from Egypt. Wow. And all these different locations to see how do we utilize digital technology and digital marketing to reach people who are contemplating suicide.
Mm. Wow, oh, what an impact. That also, that just affirms you are famous.
How many people were in the room that you were talking to?
I don't know the capacity. thankfully, it was dark enough. But one of the things that I'm really grateful for is that my mom and my brother were in the audience.
Oh,
I absolutely love them. My younger brother is finishing off his PhD as well, and is one of the people I love most on the face of this earth. And if you watch the video, right at the end, some people actually stood up as they were clapping. Oh. The first person you see stand up was my younger brother.
Oh,
and he was right in front of me when I was on that stage.
And you could see him?
I could see him.
Oh, that's good.
I could see him.
That's I mean, I feel like my next question was going to be, what's your proudest moment? It sounds like that could definitely be up there. But any others that spring to mind?
Yeah, it's definitely up there. I think I've been really fortunate to be able to witness some pretty incredible things. So when we were developing the national strategy, one thing that we noticed, and it goes back to context, is that Indonesia had some of the best written mental health legislation in the 1960s. We're here 60 years later, very little has changed. Mm. And in fact, there's been a drastic drop in the care provided and our understanding and how forward we were in terms of understanding psychiatry. So I thought, what's the disconnect? Mm. And one of the things where I think we slipped off a little bit is because the country is deeply, deeply, deeply religious. And we were trying to communicate to them using medical terms. Mm. So you can ask any person who's done mental health talks in Indonesia, and it's very likely they'll tell you the same thing. That every time we get a talk, a very common question is, how do we tell it when somebody's mentally ill or has a mental health condition or if they're possessed?
What?
That's a question that we get almost every single time.
Wow.
Why? Because a lot of people living in Australia may not realize it, but spirituality and culture and religion is embedded within the Indonesian culture. Not only Indonesia, but many different countries out there that make up the majority of the world. And so we thought to ourselves, look, they're not going to listen to us. They're not going to listen to me. They're going to listen to the religious leaders. And so we got together in Lombok, which is this little island off Bali. Mm. And we locked ourselves in a room and we had religious leaders representing the 270 million people in the country on a national level. We worked together with key partners and we said, we need to make a declaration for the country. It can't be a whole book. It needs to be five statements. Mm-hmm. Five statements that we all agree on according to mental health and suicide prevention. Now, keep in mind that interreligious violence was not uncommon in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. And so that was very sensitive territory, especially if we're talking about beliefs, right? Mm-hmm. But incredibly, after 2 days, we have what we call the Lombok Declaration. And in some, I'm not going to mention the whole thing, but in some, what it basically says is you don't need to be ashamed about having a mental health condition. It happens mm-hmm. to everybody. Mm-hmm. Seek help, help other people, don't discriminate. And it's all of our responsibility.
Yeah.
According to religion and according to theology. And mm-hmm. as part of the process, I actually had to study different texts. I actually learned how to read a passage in ancient Hebrew wow. to be able to communicate and understand a lot of these different religions. Now, yeah. we got that signed as part of G20. Mm. And I thought to myself, well, if we want to have a declaration, there's no point if nobody hears it. That's not really much of a declaration, right? So what can we do where people get excited and think about it? And so I thought, let's go for a Guinness World Record. So one of the Guinness World Record we went for, because it was a hybrid situation at the time, for the largest online mental health lesson. Mm-hmm. And so we got there together. We had the religious leaders, including the former First Lady, come and sign. And this was part of the G20 event, but one of the ones that we had in Jakarta. We then had an education session led by me, and also one of the technical officer at the WHO Indonesian office. And we had the person coming from Japan, the Guinness World Record examiner and everything. Mm-hmm. And we found out that we got the Guinness World Record.
Wow.
And that means a lot to me because it makes Indonesia, from my understanding, the first low to middle income country with a mental health Guinness World Record.
Wow.
But that's not the proudest moment yet. Because we found out around that same time, Indonesia was revamping their entire health legislation. Mm-hmm. Entire health legislation where they're completely rewriting everything. Mm. Absolutely everything. And so we were asked by the Minister of Health to give input. And they got thousands and thousands and thousands of different suggestions of different parts of the health legislation. Ours was really simple. And it was a letter written by us and the religious leaders who we know hold a lot of power in the country. Mental health and suicide aren't the same. There's a lot of people who attempt suicide that don't have a diagnosable mental health condition mm-hmm. and vice versa. Mm-hmm. Meaning that we need to be able to separate the two to be able to tackle both. And of course, I did something a little bit sneaky where I'm like, here are 10 pages of revision, or you can change this one paragraph and says that everything you said about mental health also applies to suicide prevention.
More work, less work.
Exactly. Yeah. I got a WhatsApp Easter last year saying, all right, Sandy, we've included it. We will protect its inclusion all the way to the parliamentary floor.
Wow.
A couple months later, there was no news. Suddenly we saw it's passed. I checked and there it is. Suicide prevention in Indonesian legislation.
Wow. God,
that's amazing.
And so I was so happy that, and I've never told anyone this particular bit. I was so happy that nobody was looking. I did like karate kicks in my own room. That's how I celebrate, apparently.
Oh my God.
So that's
crazy.
That's probably my proudest moment.
Congratulations. Wow, that story.
But one thing that I do have to mention, and this is the part that people often don't know, mm. is that it came at a really big cost and sacrifice. Mm-hmm. So in order to have the event, that wouldn't have happened without the Lombok Declaration. Mm. The Lombok Declaration wouldn't have been signed without the event. The person who actually led the event management pro bono was my wife.
What?
And we were just married that year. And the thing is, we were 2 weeks out. We had created space for thousands of people, and maybe only 200 people had signed up. So my wife and I, we were staying awake because we didn't only risk our time. Mm. We were short 20 grand that we had to put out of pocket as a newlywed couple. We risked everything, our reputation, our finances, even putting down payment for a house. Oh my gosh. And so when we went in on the day and we saw it full, thousands and thousands of people, afterwards we just got home and we just wept. Mm. Because we put everything we had on the line for that. And I wouldn't have been able to do it without my partner.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that is insane. There's like three really proud moments. I'm sure there's many more. Oh my God. And like, wow, what a risk for you both to take in such like a fresh honeymoon, you know, kind of period. But actually, wow, that would have been like, probably it would feel more amazing having done that than actually gone on a really fancy holiday or whatever, you know, like means so much more. But you know what I mean.
Yeah. Wow. That's
oh my
incredible.
Gosh. Yeah. God, I wish I was you. Well, I think to wrap up a little bit, we're nearing the end, sorry, of the podcast. I think it would be a really good time for you to speak to, like, I suppose, Black Dog and your team and obviously the culture there. And obviously people might want to work for Black Dog at some stage, or they might want to reach out to you, I suppose, just to allow that connection. So maybe you could talk to that part as well. Shameless plugs as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I think that, so Black Dog has this motto, which is science, compassion, action. And I think it sums it up really well, because science without compassion is cold. Data without compassion is cold. But compassion without science and data can't really do much. Mm. We need a combination of both science and compassion and actually put into action. That's why in Black Dog Institute, we have the research, we have the policy and advocacy team, we have an implementation team to make sure that our research actually gets implemented to help the people it's meant to help. Mm. And I think that one of the things I'd highly encourage people, two things. Number one, if anything at all I've said has given you an idea, or you'd like to partner, or you'd like to support us, please, please, please do reach out. As an NGO, we really do rely on the generosity of our partners, Precision Sourcing included, and that's what we're really grateful for. But we need these partnerships to be able to continue doing what we do. And number two is that not only in terms of partnerships, but if you have an idea for suicide prevention. Because remember, suicide prevention isn't just psychiatry. Mm. It's not just about medicine. And I genuinely believe, and I've said this before, that I think the solution for suicide prevention will come outside, from outside the suicide prevention field. Mm. If you have an idea, if there's an expertise, if there's a skill, if there's something you're seeing that you think, you know, this could really work, please also reach out as well. We're more than happy to think about it and collaborate and find out how we're able to bring that to life.
That's amazing. I'm going to sign up. Maybe I'll just like move over to Black Dog. No, <don't>. By Precision. No, I'm kidding. Well, thank you so much for being vulnerable and sharing. And I think this is going to be quite impactful to a lot of people out there in our audience, and even just new people that I suppose are now going to know about Black Dog and your story as well. So thank you so much for
thanks for
being
having
on.
Me. Wonderful no being here.
Thanks.